to a podcast from The National.
It is a season to be jolly. There is a stocking full of games still to be played. We do not have enough mouths to cover them, so instead we will be looking back on the Premier League year that was 2017. I'm your host, Steve Luckins. This is the Extra Time podcast. Joining me this week is sports editor Graham Cagle. Graham, season's greetings to you.
Season's greetings to you too, Steve.
How was it, mate?
It's been good. It's been hard to keep up with all the football because it's a period we love, but it's just absolutely relentless. It's just non-stop.
I know. The Premier League players all want a break, but it will lose me forever if there's ever a break during the festive period for Premier League.
Oh, completely. I don't know.
It's what gets me through the season.
I don't know how managers cope, though, because my fantasy team's been an absolute disaster during this period. So I don't know how they cope with changing their team every couple of days.
Well, it's hard to keep on top of, Gray. And like you say, like I said at the top of the show, there's so many fixtures that by the time that we broadcast, we'll be completely out of date. So not gonna look ahead too much in terms of the short term, in terms of fixtures. Let's have a look back on 2017. Quite a year for a number of players, a number of teams. Where do we start? I think we have to start on Harry Kane. I think 2017 was the year of Harry Kane. Not only did he smash Alan Shearer's record for numbers of goals in a calendar year, finished with more hat-tricks than I had turkey dinners. Just how good has he become in the past 12 months?
I think he's become the all-round package. I think he's an absolute leader on the pitch now as well. Leaders, maybe initially when he broke from the Spurs team, before he was just scoring. And I think you sometimes had the impression with him that he didn't always know what he was doing himself when in that position. But now I think it helps that he's got a great little forward line behind him, Christian Eriksen and Dele Alli, but he leads that line up so well. He's a fantastic finisher. And I think he's a great role model as well. You rarely see any attitude from him on the pitch. He's a great example. And when you think, he's broken Alan Shearer's record, and when you think back to Alan Shearer when he did it in 1995, he was playing in a championship winning side.
Yeah. And he was playing as a two as well. Yeah. He always had that support. Like you said, you mentioned Christian Eriksen, Dele Alli. But pretty much since he broke into the team, Kane has been the tip of that attack on his own, which I think makes it even more incredible what he has achieved.
Oh, no, completely. When, as I said, not wishing to do too much of a comparison with Alan Shearer, but as you said, Shearer was working as a two, and he had Wilcox and Ripley just parking it on his forehead.
Yeah.
And almost with Alan, you could almost see the lines running. But as you said, Harry's on his own a lot of the time up front, and the work rate he does, going covering all sides of the pitch, and he scores from everywhere.
Yeah.
Headers, shots outside the box.
And I'll tell you, the perfect example of what you just said was the, I forget which hat-trick, the one against Burnley. Now, finisher in the penalty spot, and then the third goal where he won the ball back himself, like you said, his work rate, and then the finish. And something that stands out for Harry Kane, and when I think of Harry Kane, I think of Zlatan Ibrahimovic, they find angles. So many of his goals go in the side netting, his radar is just switched on, isn't it?
It's terrific. You read about how much work he does in training, and it sort of shows. Like, this is a guy who, I think even if Tottenham runs themselves, probably wasn't someone they were expecting to come through, because it's always one of those what-if moments. What if Roberto Soldado had done well at Spurs when he came in? Because I'm not sure if Harry would have really had the opportunities he did.
Soldado always threatened to give someone a really good idea, yeah. I thought. It just never happened for him.
And then in many ways, Harry is a great example of why the Europa League can be beneficial to sides as well. Because he got his game time there, he got his confidence, and they gave him a go. And he's been a wonderful success story, and not only for Tottenham, but for England as well, because without him next summer at the World Cup will be frightening. And he is he's a different centre-forward, but he's almost a bit of a traditional centre-forward as well. And I think he will cause teams at the World Cup problems.
Yeah, definitely. With his finishing alone, he'll definitely cause problems. And England, obviously, and Spurs will be hoping that he maintains that form throughout the season. So I guess the next question in terms of what next for Harry Kane is, can he fulfil his ambitions at Spurs? Do you think each goal he scores, all that is really doing is burgeoning his reputation and, making him flip up on the radar of bigger clubs? And I'm thinking Real Madrid here. I think having seen his qualities up close and personal in the two Champions League group games, one of our sources has let us know that Real were very much readying themselves for a bid before those games. And if they're not now, either in January or in the summer, then, you know, Spurs will escape their clutches one of the very rare times that they do.
It will be fascinating to see. I think it will be the summer, I imagine. I think normally, particularly in World Cup year, it's a lot of fun, the transfer window in that period, because I think probably if you're Real, you probably would want to see how he handles the World Cup, possibly with a better coach or a coach with a plan, because Harry suffered like a lot of England players at the 2016 Euros with Roy Hodgson being very muddled and being obsessed with playing Rain Rooney no matter what the logic dictated.
And making Harry Kane take corners.
Yeah, exactly. if Harry's taking corners in Russia, there's a big problem.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see if anyone from England comes in from as well, because I think Jose rates him quite highly, and I don't know what kind of budget Manchester United have, but they need... The problem with Lukaku is he works well, but in a way, Harry's highlighting just what he doesn't do.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So, and there's still always these constant rumblings at Manchester City about Sergio Aguero not being happy and stuff. He'd be a very different forward to Sergio Aguero, but Pep does like to sort of change things up as he goes. And Harry Kane with that service could be absolutely frightening as well. From Harry's point of view, I think he's very, very loyal to Tottenham. He's come through the ranks, and as the fans sing, he is one of their own. But from his point of view, what he's got to question is this as good as it's got for Tottenham? Is this going to be as good as it gets? Because it's going to be very, very difficult with Man City now on this amazing run where who knows where this is going to kind of go with them in 2018. But Manchester United, sort of under Mourinho, have sort of sorted themselves out a bit. Chelsea under Conte, we don't know. And Liverpool have shown a lot of ambition with their recent work in the transfer window. And obviously they've got an amazing forward line. So hindsight might say the last couple of seasons were Tottenham's great opportunity to win a title out of nowhere.
Absolutely.
And so Harry's got to weigh that up. Loyalty against, is this the time to move on? Because I don't think, if it's done right, I don't think any Spurs fan would begrudge him it.
Yeah.
Because like, he certainly hasn't left anything on the pitch. So
I think it's absolutely seminal that Spurs give him a Champions League platform next season. Now, obviously, moving to Wembley, you know, the Spurs were always going to struggle. They were never going to replicate their White Hart Lane form at Wembley. So I think the move back to White Hart Lane next season, if there's Champions League football on the table, I think that is their best shot of keeping Harry Kane. But, you know, Harry Kane had a great year. Someone else I've written down here who may not immediately spring to mind, but I'm looking at Wayne Rooney. Now, we have to cast our minds back to literally almost 12 months ago, on January 22nd, I believe, where he broke Bobby Charlton's scoring record for Manchester United, which obviously is a great achievement. He was 250th goal. Don't know if you remember it, a great free kick against Stoke. And, you know, he played a peripheral role at United throughout the rest of the season in their League Cup winning campaign, Europa League. Got his move back to Everton, scored on his return. Then the club went into a slump, and Rooney was very much picked on, I think, in most cases, for a reason for that, where I think it's quite obvious now with a change of personnel and manager that it's quite obvious where the blame lied. And he's enjoying a little bit of a resurgence as a kind of leader on the pitch under Sam Allardyce again. So I think you could argue it's been a decent year for Wayne Rooney.
Oh, no, absolutely. In a way, it's kind of funny watching him work so well with Allardyce, kind of wondering what could have happened if Sam hadn't been kicked out of England, just because I think he had ideas on how to use Rain better, really, than Hodgson had done. And as you said, he's matured greatly. I think he handled the move to Everton with dignity. And I think he's enjoying the different limelight away from United, I think, a little bit. Just like the chance, you know, realistically, they're not going to win any silverware.
Yeah. Well, but he was only going to fall down the pecking order at United with the signing of Lukaku.
Oh, realistically. And yeah. He's lost his pace. It's always going to be a bit of a... That was a real factor from early on. And I think probably playing in that midfield role is probably more natural for him going, but I think at Everton, it's working out well where he's playing and such in the role he's positioned. At England, it was always the case he wasn't quite good enough at that position for international football. I'll be interested to see where he goes on in 2018 under Allardyce, because normally with Allardyce sides you get this like upsurge when Sam arrives because he organises you, but it's where they kind of go next. And the one thing with that Everton team so far, they lack a little bit of pace and such, and Rain will give them good leadership, but they do, you do wonder long term where the goals are going to come with that side still.
Well, the transfer window's about to open, so it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, the master wheeler and dealer has got a few names in mind to come in and address those problems. Now, I know we're going to kind of not strictly, but we're going to focus mostly on the Premier League, but I feel it would be remiss not to mention Real Madrid. Now, bar the Copa del Rey, Zinedine Zidane's side swept all before them in 2017. They won the Liga, repeated the Champions League, won the UEFA and Spanish Super Cups, and to crown it all, they retained the FIFA Club World Cup right here in Abu Dhabi. And despite what can only be considered a huge success in anyone's history, especially in Real Madrid's, it's the first time they've won five trophies in a season, you almost feel like Zinedine Zidane's under a little bit of pressure purely because of how far Real are behind Barcelona in La Liga. They trail by 14 points, just been beaten in El Clasico, but no manager who's delivered five trophies should really be feeling that kind of downward pressure, should they?
It's mad. It kind of just highlights just how short-term football is now. Like, I know it's always the easy cliche to go back to how much time Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United when he first took over, and we say that would never happen now. But it is just in a crazy scenario where Real Madrid looked like coming from this amazing year to 2018 could be a horrific year for them, possibly. It's going to have to take a hell of a collapse from Barcelona for them not to get to retain the title. You can easily see him going out of the Champions League to PSG. And Ronaldo is apparently, if you believe the media in Spain, getting very sniffy with the president, Perez, about wanting a new contract and stuff, and apparently putting out come-and-get-me signs to United and PSG. So it could be a real change of guard in the summer. And like, you'd have to say, logically, Zidane, certainly, you can think what he inherited as well when he took over Real Madrid.
Yeah, from Benitez, definitely.
Yeah, that was not an easy job he took over. That was a broken dressing room and stuff. And he's, obviously, it helps if you're Zinedine Zidane, you command respect when you walk in the dressing room. So I think with the reputation he's got, he surely must have enough credit in the bank.
Exactly. If five trophies isn't enough credit in your account, then nothing is it?
Because as you hinted with Harry, I think there'll be a big reshuffle in the summer. They might well go for Harry Kane. There might be other names. There's all sorts of rumours going around about Neymar possibly ending up there. I think they will be one of the clubs to watch in the summer. So, but in answer to your question, I think Zidane's got to be. If they do get rid of Zidane, then that's one of the harshest firings of the year in the prediction.
Well, a club well known for it. Okay, so back to English shores. Again, if it's remiss to not mention Real Madrid, what Pep Guardiola and Manchester City have achieved in the first half of this season. The football they play is as good as any, not just the Premier League era, any era. The football is scintillating, quite frankly. And it's becoming very obvious why City were prepared to lay the groundwork over 3 years' worth of work to land Pep Guardiola. You know, it didn't quite work for him last season. But again, I don't think he should be judged too harshly on that. He's a foreign manager coming into a very, very tough league. Just because he did it at Barca and Bayern, it was no automatic guarantee he was going to do it at City. And, you know, again, he's had massive backing financially, but he's invested that very, very wisely in the summer. They're on a record-breaking run. They can extend that run to 19 wins with victory over Crystal Palace and who else they have on the agenda over the next few days. But when you look at that record, Gray, and you consider that he also went on a 19-game winning run with Bayern, a 16-game winning run with Barcelona, I mean, those numbers are incredible. They are absolutely incredible, and it's very hard to argue against the fact that he's cracked the Premier League.
Oh, completely. As you said, it's not just a run, it's a style of football. Because there's been some huge scorelines I've seen. Like, I saw them put six past Watford in September, and the scary thing was Watford didn't do a lot wrong in that game.
Yeah.
And it could have been easily more than six. But I think this performance that still stands out for me was the Chelsea game, when they put the champions on the back foot, and it was the most one-sided 1-0 you ever see.
Yeah, absolutely. De Bruyne has scored.
Because they play scintillating football, but the work rate of the team, they are phenomenally fit. I'd love to know how much work he did with them and what he had them doing. Because when they don't have the ball, the pressing game is straight on Pete. And the pressing game sounds great on paper, but you've got to be really fit to be able to do that. And
in sync as well. You know, people say the pressing game like it's just one player going after a ball. It's not. It's Wolfpacks. It's your line of attackers, midfield, defenders, all knowing when to surround certain players, all knowing when to stand still. So much thought goes into it. And I guess a byproduct of Guardiola and City's success this season undoubtedly has been Raheem Sterling. Now, he's becoming that rarity amongst English footballers in that he's someone who is fulfilling his potential and his early promise. You know, he's a match winner now. He, in the crucial situations, he makes the right decisions where before he didn't. And you know, he's a go-to guy in a Guardiola team. Now, there can be no higher praise for a player, can there?
Oh, no, absolutely. Pep's kind of got a tradition of doing that with other clubs. And you look at not just him, maybe Fabian Delph as well, who... and you laugh.
An average midfielder turned into an okay left-back.
Yeah, exactly. There's clearly his work ethic really goes on. But as you said, with Raheem, he's been phenomenal to watch because 4 or 5 years ago, we thought he was going to be a huge breakout star at Liverpool. And he went to the World Cup in 2014 on the back of Liverpool's great season. You thought at this point, this boy's going to be a superstar.
Yeah.
And then it was a bit unfortunate. Liverpool dipped quite badly after Suarez left and he was stuck in a very average team. And then it's fair to say he didn't really click at City immediately. But as you said, like with Guardiola's work that he's done with him, it's been fantastic to watch. And as with everyone else, I include him in the work rate. He'll track back, really do. The interesting challenge for him is going to be see how he fares. Does he become more of a leader for England? Because he's going to be an outstanding player playing with not as good individuals.
Yeah, yeah.
In absolutely. A week. Because we're looking like the England team will be a lot weaker than that City team.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly.
Most teams are.
Yeah. Well, quite frankly, if you could enter almost like a FIFA tournament and put that City team as the 33rd team at the World Cup finals next year. It'd be hard not to think they'd win it, frankly, the way they're playing. So they've been a joy to watch. And I
think that's another reason to look at Guardiola and his style of management and just think that, you know, he deserves all the plaudits he's coming his way. Like you said, Sterling didn't really click early start to his City career, yet Guardiola identified something in him and he thought he could get more out of him. Whereas someone like Claudio Bravo, who he signed last season in the summer, he knew that was an area that needed addressing. So he bought in another goalkeeper for a lot of money, and that has proved to be the right decision. So it just goes to show that Guardiola knows when he's got talent on his books and he knows when he's got to, you know, drop the axe on someone.
Oh, no, completely. He's ruthless, but you have to be at that level of game because if he shows a bit of loyalty to that keeper and then that he doesn't rate, like Claudio Bravo may have had some doubts about. In the big games, if he's making errors, that it's keepers who can, with a simple error, can cost you big tournaments and big results. And in a way, and it's been the motivation, he's kept Claudio Bravo on side because obviously he's done very well in the League Cup and he was a hero against Leicester City and he's kept City on track for this.
It seems that he can save anything as long as it's a penalty. Anything else that's here, he can't get near.
Yes, yeah, it's an interesting problem to have. So, but as I said, it's going to be the interesting element for City is going to be, can they keep this up in 2018 with four tours? Because if they keep this up, they're probably looking at playing twice a week from February onwards when a lot of teams won't be. And so you're going to be having, particularly in April, a lot of sides going fresher. Because do you think they can do the league season unbeaten?
Yeah, quite easily, quite easily. It just, like you said earlier, the types of games they've won this season, you know, so many, they've won 4 or 5 games in the last 10 minutes. You know, they've broken down teams that sat off them. More and more you've seen teams having a real go at them. You know, we know where their weaknesses are, and I think a direct ball towards their centre-backs. More teams have been playing that probably since the West Ham game.
Mm.
And they've dealt with that as well. So, you know, we are still yet to figure out how to beat City. And I think with the size of that squad, the players they have, you know, rotation obviously over this period in particular is going to come more and more into play. I think quite easily they'll go undefeated. I think it's the longer a winning run goes on, the sooner it will come to an end. But I don't really, I wouldn't be like to be the man who says when it's going to end.
Oh, no, completely. I'm with you on the unbeaten, on going the season unbeaten. I think the only thing would be if they got serious injuries and they have to rotate heavily, but you can't speculate. If they stay with the current form right now, it's almost impossible. I think, quite frankly, I'm surprised not more of the teams being on the phone to Wolverhampton Wanderers, who are the only side who City haven't scored against this season amazingly. Yeah. Admittedly, they're doing amazingly in the Championship, but it's still not the team you'd have picked to be the one team that stopped them so far.
Okay, more success stories in 2017. I'm guessing depends what side of the fence you're sitting on this, but Antonio Conte won the Premier League in his very first season in England. No small achievement. Nearly won the double, but was beaten in the FA Cup final by Arsenal in May. Definitely endured a difficult defence to his title reign at the start of this season, although Saturday's thumping of Stoke saw the move up to second behind City, which is as good as any other team is going to get this season, I think we'll find. How do you see 2018 working out for not just Antonio Conte, but Chelsea?
I think, as you said, second place is really got to be the goal now. And second place, if they could even get within 15 points of Man City, would be a great effort, given how City are going. But with Conte, it's difficult to see him going beyond the summer, really.
I think all the noise he's been making all season suggests that the summer is it, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't scream of... If Chelsea put a lot of investment, if he's given a lot of funds in January as a let's finish the season strong, let's do some business early, let's sort of work for the summer, we're aiming to start next season really strong, let's really show some faith in you, that might be a sign to really get him on side, because he wasn't shy about coming forward about the fact he didn't think they did anywhere near enough business in the summer.
Despite having 35 players or whatever it is out on loan. Threadbare squad.
Yeah, exactly. And questions did have to be asked about the whole Diego Costa affair, in terms of obviously Diego does seem like a bit of a hard character to get on with.
But we'll be seeing him play soon, won't we?
Yeah. but the bridges didn't probably have to be as burned as badly as they were, and Conte has to play at least some part in that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was bad management. Obviously the player let that information leak, but Conte put himself in a position where it was easy for the player to do that. It was easy for the player to turn the heat on Conte.
Because the irony has been that that's not been the problem replacing him, because Morata's been a sensational signing.
Sure, yep.
But you've got to wonder with the sort of spirit in the dressing room and stuff, and they've lost a lot of games that they wouldn't have lost last season, and it's no coincidence that they've sorted themselves out a lot more since Eden Hazard came in the team, but there does seem to... They do miss Costa, I still think, in like that West Ham game that they lost a couple of weeks ago. Yep. Morata's sort of a very good forward, but sometimes you need someone like a Costa. Yeah, he'll miss about three or four games a season through suspension, but he'll get in players' face, he'll ruffle opponents and stuff.
He's just a very difficult striker to contain, isn't he? No one wants to come up against Messi and Ronaldo, but not many defenders will relish the physical challenge of coming up against Diego Costa.
So he's kind of like the last of a dying breed, really, in many ways, and sort of... I'm not sure what was going on behind the scenes, but it did feel weird that they were so willing to force out someone who could be a difference maker, I'm not sure if they could have... I'm sure, obviously, with Chelsea's ranks, they could have had Morata and Costa, maybe, like Man City have.
Yeah,
it is more about squad depth, because Chelsea do feel like they've got a great first 11, and then...
Not much beyond.
And considering that Conte seems reluctant to play any other striker if Morata's not around, he'll play anyone else. I'm amazed Gary Cahill's not had a run out front, quite frankly. So he seems to be committed to anyone else if Morata's not in, but in the actual strikers he's got.
Yeah, and I guess, if we're talking about success stories of 2017, and Morata definitely is one, but there's been more than a few, and particularly at Chelsea, who have really struggled, and I think Cahill is one of them. His form has dipped alarmingly. David Luiz is obviously, persona non grata at Chelsea after the falling out between manager and player during the Champions League game against Roma, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right.
He's not played in the Premier League since then. So you're talking about two stalwarts of that Premier League title-winning team. And I think with the emergence of Andreas Christensen and Antoni Rudiger as frontline defenders, I think the writing could be on the wall for one, maybe both of Cahill and David Luiz in 2018.
Well, it'll be interesting if Luiz is still there after this transfer window coming up, because if it is as bad as it sort of looks like, if you're not playing him, then what's the point of having him?
Yeah.
And, if a club bids, if someone comes in with even 20, 25 million, Chelsea might be interested in that if they can sort of recruit and give options. And it does feel like the writing is on the wall, particularly for Luiz, because Conte's, I remember he was really singing Christensen's name in glowing terms. I think it was after they beat Bournemouth in the League Cup. And were saying, oh, he's going to be the next John Terry and stuff like that. And it was like, almost felt like a bit like he was trying to convince himself of that rather than the actual sort of media and the player himself. So going back to the original question, I think it is a big changing time at Chelsea. There's obviously rumours about Hazard as well. Like, will Real Madrid go after him as well in the summer?
Well, this is it. Last summer, they were very much interested in him, but he broke his ankle, didn't he? Or fractured his ankle, which kind of ruled him out for the first 2 or 3 months of the season, which would have called anyone's interest, I guess. But yeah, it will be interesting to see if they come back for him.
It feels like a change in the guard time at Chelsea. And yeah, I can't see Conte hanging around personally. That would be a prediction for 2018. I think he's done his bit. He's ticked his box, won a title in England, go back to Italy, where it's a strange thing to say, he might be a little bit calmer.
Who would have thought? Okay, another player that we can't fail to mention. He's been in England less than 6 months, and he's torn down the house. What an impact Mohamed Salah has made at Liverpool. Another brace in the comeback win against Leicester. He's at 22 goals for the season. Now, despite what some of our reporters here at the National Way think, he is a hell of a finisher, quite frankly. And although we're probably a little too early to talk about player of the season, if he's not nominated, that will be a travesty.
Oh, no, completely. You've got to think of just... it. Almost his success up front almost highlights just how bad Liverpool's defence has been. The fact that he's done that well for them and they're not within 10 points of Manchester City at the top highlights just how bad that defence has been.
Have you ever known a disparity between the quality of an attack and a poorest defence like Liverpool? I've never seen a team like it.
It's ludicrous. Like, you've got Firmino's really kicking on as well. Again, he had a good start season and he's now back on form. Sadio Mane's a great player as well. And you've got Coutinho, of course. He might not be with Liverpool for much longer, but it's an amazing front four they've got. And then you've got this utter dross at the back. Yeah. Sort of like... and it sometimes feels like Klopp has been doing sort of diversion tactics and stuff to take away from it, but they've put their money where their mouth is now with Van Dijk, and sort of it'll be interesting to see. Like, I remember, I think it was Gary Neville who was very critical early in the season of and said that when Van Dijk was linked to him in summer, said he wouldn't. It isn't just the players. You know, it's one individual can't turn that round. That's the entire defence.
Yeah, no, it's structural. Yeah, definitely.
Because Klopp's obviously getting the hump about being accused of not being a very defensive coach and claiming that, oh no, we do work on this stuff. Well, I don't know what they're working on, but
he said that in his press conference the other day, didn't he? He said there's little we can do about conceding from set pieces. Like, well, no, I think there is.
Yeah, there's lots you can do.
You know, the zonal defence, and I think a lot of coaches get this wrong in the way they set up their defenders. They'll often set up their biggest players in that kind of line, and have their smaller runners go with runners in the box. And Liverpool do this. Well, no, stick your best headers on their best header of the ball, and that should negate their threat in the air. But what do I know? I'm not a Premier League manager.
But as you said, it's an interesting point, because with Salah, obviously he's had a sensational season, and he'll be a man to watch at the World Cup with Egypt as well. And because Egypt have got a cracking chance of getting out of their group, I think, and making a name for themselves. And if Liverpool don't get Champions League, and it's not nailed on, as we were talking about Tottenham and Harry Kane, I think there's a lot of interesting scenarios here, because obviously United are a little bit out of form at the moment, but if we're presuming that City and United are going to get 2 of the spots, and Chelsea look like they've sorted themselves out a bit, you're looking at Liverpool, Tottenham and Arsenal going for the 4th place, which I think is going to be one of the main narratives of the second half of the season. I think it was some of the most interesting is going to be, because if Salah has a great World Cup...
yep.
And Liverpool are offering him Europa League next season, and Klopp presumably... I'd be interested to see if Klopp survived the summer, because for all the Liverpool loving that they've given him, if he takes him back out of the Champions League after all the money he's invested in them, and quite clear errors in the side, then Salah will be a man in demand as well. Yeah. And so it's going to be a very interesting next 8 or 9 months for him. I think he still will be living for Liverpool, because at the moment... but Salah, at the moment, there's a serious prospect that one of Salah or Harry Kane might not qualify for the Champions League, which seems like a ludicrous situation on paper. But
yeah, you're right. Again, there's been some other hires of 2017. For me personally, I think welcoming 2 new teams to the Premier League in Brighton and Huddersfield, you know, it's always sad when teams drop out, and you know, teams like Sheffield Wednesday and Leeds United, you know, the latter especially nearly going out of existence just from dropping out of the Premier League. But it is always nice to welcome new teams to the Premier League, I feel. How do you feel those two teams have acquitted themselves?
I think Huddersfield have probably had the more high-profile interest because they were the team that no one had any expectation, because Brighton had gone close the previous season and been edged out by Middlesbrough. But Huddersfield have been a great success story. No one expected them to come up. And obviously beating Man United is a game that their fans will remember. And then they absolutely whacked Watford 4-1 a couple of weeks ago. And they're doing quite well. They're picking up points as they go along.
Yeah.
I'm more confident in them staying in the Premier League than Brighton, which I wouldn't have predicted at the start of the season. I think everyone just presumed Huddersfield would be in it for an in-and-out season. But with Brighton, Chris Hughton's a great coach and he's done a great job of them. But you just fear there's not enough goals in that side, and at some point that's going to hurt them. And that what they need another striker in January, because with all due respect to Glenn Murray, he's not going to get enough goals for them.
No, he's a journeyman Championship striker who will chip in with goals. But yeah, if you're talking as a frontline goal getter, no, yeah, you know, it's not just promoted teams, it's every team. You've got to keep goals out and you've got to score goals. And Brighton are fairly good at doing one and not the other. So yeah, it will be very interesting to see who they acquire in January, if anyone.
I'll be interested to see how aggressive they go, or whether they go with a tactic that Burnley did, which was Sean Dyche took Burnley up. That first season, they didn't throw money around. They stuck to their principles. They had a good go at it, but got relegated. But then they were well set up in the Championship, came back even stronger.
Yep.
And now they had a very good first season up, and now they're having an exceptional second season. Now, that's not going to happen with every team, but it proves you don't... that. Getting relegated in the first season doesn't have to be the end of the world,
yeah,
if you run your club properly. And neither Brighton or Huddersfield have thrown money around, so I'm confident both of them are reasonably set up. And you're not going to see a scenario like a Birmingham City or a Sunderland or a Hull City that's going on in the Premier League, in the Championship right now, where all three of those clubs are near the bottom of their table and facing possibly dropping down to the third tier.
Yeah. Well, I don't really want to end the year on a negative note, but I think... A body of players that have really struggled this season. One we've already touched on, Claudio Bravo. But I think it's been a really bad year for goalkeepers. Now, I'm thinking of, Joe Hart, who obviously was farmed out on loan to West Ham, lost his place to Adrian already. And Hart's dip in form opened the gate for his backups in the England setup to stake a claim. Fraser Forster at Southampton and Jack Butland at Stoke. But they've arguably had even worse seasons than Joe Hart has. Forster was dropped for the game against United. Stoke, I think the 5 they conceded against Chelsea took them very near, either on 50 goals conceded or very near to it. So you feel like they've almost blown their opportunities to stake a claim in World Cup year.
It's an odd situation. Like, at the moment, you'd be a very brave person to predict who's going to be in goal for him. Because
who should be in goal for England at the World Cup?
Right now, scarily, I would probably still say Hart. Scarily, because I can't think of anyone else. It's like, because ultimately, a little bit, because you could drop someone in quite young, like, I don't know if he's fit, Tom Heaton at Burnley could have a shout.
Well, he's out injured at the moment,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, so that's a doubt. But if Heaton was fit, you'd maybe give him a... But then do you really want to drop in a goalkeeper at a World Cup? But then, no, although,
bring back David Seaman.
Well, yeah, well, quite frankly, or Ray Clements or something like that. Because on the one hand, like, I'm almost disagreeing with my own logic here. Because on the one hand, at least Joe Hart's got some experience at the international stage. But he's also got experience of letting in 35-yard shots through his hands,
yeah,
on the international stage as well. And like at the Euros, he just looked a man totally...
Jordan Pickford?
Could be a good shout.
Yeah.
I was like, I think this is going to be the crucial thing for Southgate. He's got to really sort of try and make some early calls on it, or experiment a little bit in the friendlies coming up, and have the confidence to say to them, look, just go out there and enjoy yourself. You know, you're not going to be decided on one game. That might be a lie, but tell them that. But just sort of see how they handle the stage. But yeah, Jordan Pickford's probably a great shout, in fairness. He's probably been one of the few success stories at Everton and before Big Sam came in to save the day.
Yeah, you're right. Well, on that note, Graham, I think we're going to have to sign off for 2017. What a year it's been. Thank you very much for joining us.
No, cheers, Steve. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Of course, Happy New Year to all our listeners as well. You can download the Extra Time podcast on iTunes or find us on the website at www.thenational.ae/sport or follow us on Twitter at NatSportUAE. Thanks for listening.